Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. So today I've chosen sutta number 143 in the Majjhima Nikaya, Anathapindika Ovada Sutta, Advice to Anathapindika. And I've chosen this one because it's quite short, but it also refers to one of the chief disciples, lay disciples of the Buddha. And in the talk that I gave on Friday night, we heard about a slave girl who was in the household of Anathapindika and heard the Buddha's teachings and became a stream winner on the first stage to the path to enlightenment and left the household life with Anathapindika's approval, became a nun and became fully enlightened. And I made the point at the time that although she was born into a slave family and she was in the household as a servant, that it was her good fortune to be in that household because she was able to have contact with the Buddha and hear his teachings at first hand, because Anathapindika was one of the foremost lay disciples of the Buddha. And it's interesting in this particular sutta that we hear Anathapindika saying that towards the end of the sutta, he hasn't heard the teachings on insight from the disciples of the Buddha, even though he's heard many discourses. And so I'd like to make a feature of that point as we get on. So just to just have that in mind. And I thought to begin with, before we get into the sutta itself, I would just give you some background information on Anathapindika. Because when we hear many of the Buddha's discourses, we hear that they are given at Anathapindika's monastery in Sarvasti. And in fact, the Buddha spent 24 rainy seasons there, and many of the most important teachings were given at this monastery. And when Anathapindika first became a disciple of the Buddha, he encouraged other people to also listen to the teachings and to offer support. And so he's the lay disciple that we hear given the title of the foremost benefactor of the Sangha amongst the male lay disciples. And I think it's important to recognize that, and also to have some background into who we're looking at in this sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. So I'd like to read you the account of how Anathapindika came to first meet the Buddha, and also what transpired in that meeting, which will also have a bearing on the wisdom teaching in the sutta that we're going to look at. So I'm reading from The Life of the Buddha, but this is actually found, this account is found in the Vinaya Pitaka, this account of how Anathapindika first came to meet the Buddha and what transpired when he did that. So the first, just to put it in context, the first rains after his enlightenment were spent by the Buddha at Benares in the deer park, The second and third were spent at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, which was given to him by King Bimbisara. And it is after the third rains that Anathapindika, the feeder of the poor, makes his appearance. Anathapindika means the feeder of the poor. It's not his given name, that's his household name. In keeping with Indian tradition, and you'll even find it in Sri Lanka, people often have a name which they are known by outside the household. They are not called by their personal name. And so within the household, they may be sometimes referred to by their personal name, and only the people who are their close intimates will know that name. Otherwise, they'll be known maybe the merchant, or the timber merchant, or the doctor, but not their personal name. So Anathapindika means the feeder of the poor. And he makes his appearance in the story of the Buddha very soon after the Buddha's enlightenment, within the first three rains. And that is just to put it in context and give you the sense that for many, many years he was in contact with the Buddha. The occasion was this. The Buddha, the Blessed One, was living at that time at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, and there had been no pronouncement made by him about dwellings for bhikkhus. They were living here and there in the woods, at the root of trees, under overhanging rocks, in ravines, in hillside caves, in charnel grounds, in jungle thickets, in the open, on heaps of straw. As they left such places in the early morning, they inspired confidence, whether in moving forwards or returning, looking ahead or aside, bending or stretching. Their eyes were downcast and they moved with grace. During that time, a rich merchant of Rajagaha visited the park. He saw them as they went about thus, and in his heart he trusted them. He approached them and asked, "Lords, if I had dwellings built, would you live in them?" "The Blessed One has not allowed dwellings," they said. "Then, lords, ask the Blessed One and tell me what he says." They told this to the Blessed One. He gave his permission, and when he had done so, they told the merchant. In a single day, he had 60 dwellings built. Then he invited the Blessed One and the Sangha for the following day's meal. At the end of the meal, he formally presented the dwellings to the Sangha. The merchant's sister was the wife of Anathapindika, who chose at that time to come to Rajagaha on some business or other. At the very time, in fact, when the Sangha of bhikkhus, headed by the Buddha, had been invited by the merchant for the following day. The merchant was directing his servants and retainers, "Now get up early, cook gruel and rice and sauces, make desserts and sweets." Anathapindika thought, "Formerly, when I came, this householder used to lay aside all his engagements to welcome me. Now he seems distracted with ordering his servants about. Is there a marriage taking place, or a giving in marriage, or is there some great sacrifice, or has he invited King Bimbisara, King of Magadha, for tomorrow with a full retinue?" When the merchant had finished directing his servants, he went to Anathapindika and welcomed him. Then when he had sat down beside him, Anathapindika told him his thoughts. He replied, "There's no marriage, nor has the king been invited for tomorrow with a full retinue, but I have a great sacrifice. I have invited for tomorrow the Sangha of bhikkhus, headed by the Buddha, the Enlightened One." "Do you say the Buddha?" "I say the Buddha." "Do you say the Buddha?" "I say the Buddha." "Do you say the Buddha?" "I say the Buddha." "This news, the Buddha, is hard to come by in this world. Is it possible to go and see this Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened, now at this time?" "This is not the time to go and see him. You can see him early tomorrow." So Anathapindika is really excited at the prospect that the Buddha is, there is a Buddha, fully enlightened one, existing in the world. that Anathapindika thought, "Early tomorrow I shall be able to see a blessed one, accomplished and fully enlightened." He lay down thinking of the Buddha. Three times in the night he got up, fancying it was dawn. Then he went to the Sivik gate. Non-human beings opened the gate. So in the city of Rajagaha, it was a city which was well fortified, and it had walls all around it, and entrance and exit were only through the city gates. And so early in the morning the gate was locked. He went to the gate and non-human beings opened the gate. As soon as he was out of the city, light left him and darkness was before him. Fear, awe, and horror arose in him. He wanted to turn back, but the invisible spirit Sivika made himself heard. 100 elephants, 100 horses, 100 chariots drawn by she mules, 100,000 maidens decked with gems and earrings, all of these are not even worth a 16th part of one step forward now. Go forward, householder, go forward. Better go forward than turn back. So he's very frightened because he's out of the city in the dark on his own. And the voice in his head is saying, it's better to go forward. Don't give in to your fear. So it says in this account, it's a non-human being. You can, if you have confidence in that, you can take it as a non-human being. If you don't accept that, then you can just say the voice in his head, because he was so happy to hear that there was a fully enlightened one in the world. When the spirit had said this for the third time, darkness left him and light was before him. The fear, awe and horror subsided in him. Then he went to the cool grove where the Buddha was. Now on that occasion the Blessed One had risen early towards dawn and was pacing up and down in the open. He saw Anathapindika coming. When he saw him, he left his walk and sat down on a seat made ready for him. When he had done so, he said to Anathapindika, "Come, Sudatta." Anathapindika thought, "He addresses me by my name," and he was happy and hopeful. So the Buddha is showing that he knows who's coming, even though he's never actually met Anathapindika and hasn't been introduced to him by his family name. So Anathapindika went to the Blessed One and prostrated himself at his feet and said, "I trust that the Blessed One has slept well." And the Buddha answers in verse, "A Brahman true sleeps ever well who has attained to full Nibbana, whom sense desires leave intact, cooled without substance of existence. He has rejected all attachments. There is no conflict in his heart. He sleeps in bliss, who is at peace, the peace established in the mind." Now please note that verse. Then the Blessed One gave Anathapindika progressive instruction. While Anathapindika sat there, the spotless, immaculate vision of the Dharma arose in him. All that is subject to arising is subject to cessation. Then he became independent of others in the teacher's dispensation. He said, "Magnificent Lord, beginning from today, let the Blessed One receive me as his follower who has gone to him for refuge for as long as breath lasts. Lord, let the Blessed One with the Sangha of Bhikkhus accept tomorrow's meal from me." The Blessed One accepted in silence. Then knowing that the Blessed One had accepted, he rose from his feet, and after paying homage to the Blessed One, he departed, keeping him on his right. The rich merchant of Rajagaha, his brother-in-law, heard, "It seems that the Sangha of Bhikkhus, headed by the Buddha, has been invited by Anathapindika." So he said to Anathapindika, "The Sangha of Bhikkhus, headed by the Buddha, has been invited by you for tomorrow. But you are a guest. I will give you money to provide the food for the Sangha of Bhikkhus headed by the Buddha." "There's no need. I have money to provide food for the Sangha of Bhikkhus headed by the Buddha." A citizen of Rajagaha heard of it, and he offered to provide the money, but Anathapindika refused. And Saniya Bimbisara, king of Magadha, offered likewise and was refused. Then when the night was over, Anathapindika had good food of various kinds prepared at the merchant's house, and he had the time announced to the Blessed One. "It is time, Lord, the meal is ready." It now being morning, the Blessed One dressed, and taking his bowl and outer robe, he went accompanied by the Sangha of Bhikkhus to the merchant's house, and sat down on the seat made ready there. Then the householder, Anathapindika, served with his own hands the Sangha headed by the Buddha, and satisfied them with different kinds of good food. When the Blessed One had eaten, and no longer had the bowl in his hand, Anathapindika sat down at one side. He said to the Blessed One, "Lord, let the Blessed One with the Sangha of Bhikkhus consent to dwell with me at Savatthi for the rains." So this was his town that he came from, several hundred miles away from Rajagaha. Savatthi was with Rajagaha, the two major cities in the country at that time. So he's asking if the Buddha and the Sangha will come to Savasthi and spend the rains there. And the Buddha replies, "Perfect ones delight in rooms that are void, householder. I know, Blessed One, I know, Sublime One." Then when the Blessed One had instructed and urged and roused and encouraged Anathapindika with talk on the Dharma, he rose from his seat and went away. At that time, Anathapindika had many friends and acquaintances to welcome him. When he had finished his business in Rajagaha, he set out for Savatthi. On the way, he directed people, "Sirs, make gardens, build dwellings, arrange gifts of food. A Buddha has appeared in the world. He has been invited by me. He will come by this road." Then those people did as he had directed them. So he's encouraging other people to take the opportunity to make good karma by preparing for the Buddha. Then when Anathapindika arrived at Savatthi, he looked around for the city for a suitable place, a suitable retreat, until he saw Prince Jeta's pleasure park, which had all the requisite qualities. So he was looking for a place that was pleasant to live in, that was close enough to the city so that people could go out to hear the teaching, but also far enough away from the noise and bustle of the city so that the Buddha and the Sangha would not be disturbed. So he looked all around, and the most suitable place he saw was Prince Jeta's pleasure park, which had all the requisite qualities. He went to Prince Jeta and said, "Sir, give me your park to use. The park is not to be given without the sum of 100,000 spread over it." "The park is taken, sir." "The park is not taken, householder," this is Prince replying. They asked arbitrating officers whether it was taken or not. The arbitrator said, "As soon as you set a value on it, sir, it was taken." So Prince Jeta intended to say, you wouldn't get this except for 100,000 pieces of gold put over it, and not expecting that anyone would pay that ridiculous amount of money. And Anathapindika was so keen to obtain it for the use of the Buddha that he said he would pay that. And so the arbitrating officer said, as soon as the price was fixed, even if Prince Jeta was saying it in jest, as long as Anathapindika could meet that, then he could purchase the grove. Then Anathapindika had gold brought in carts, and he had Jeta's grove covered with 100,000 gold coins spread over it. The gold they brought at first was not enough to complete it, and there was a small space near the gate that was left uncovered. Anathapindika ordered people to go and fetch gold to cover the space. Then it occurred to Prince Jeta, "This could be no ordinary matter, since Anathapindika is spending so much gold. He told Anathapindika, "Enough, householder, do not cover that space, leave me that space, it shall be my gift." And that's how we have Anathapindika's monastery in Prince Jeta's grove. Anathapindika thought, "This Prince Jeta is a prominent, well-known person. It will be very good if such well-known people acquire confidence in the Dharma and discipline." So he left that space for Prince Jeta, who had a gatehouse built on it. Then Anathapindika had dwellings erected in Jeta's grove. He had open terraces laid out. He had gates made, waiting halls put up, fire rooms, storehouses and closets built, walks levelled, well rooms prepared, baths constructed, bathrooms arranged, ponds excavated and pavilions raised. So that is the story of how Anathapindika came to meet the Buddha, and also how the very famous monastery was established. And one of the places that we visit when we go to India on pilgrimage is the site of Anathapindika's monastery, Prince Jeta's Grove, which is still remains of the monastery that you can see. You can see the place where the Buddha had his kuti and the place where he used to walk up and down, and a tree that was planted there by Venerable Ananda. So that place is still in existence today, not being used as a monastery. It's in ruins, but it's one of the holy sites that we visit on pilgrimage to India. So that gives you the background of Anathapindika. You have some idea who he is and the background for his relationship with the Buddha and the Sangha. So now we'll look at directly at the sutta. "Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's grove, Anathapindika's park. On that occasion, the householder Anathapindika was afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill." This is many years later. No exact time is specified how many years later, but many years later. "Then Anathapindika addressed a certain man thus, 'Come, good man, go to the Blessed One, pay homage in my name with your head at his feet, and say, Venerable Sir, the householder Anathapindika is afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill. He pays homage with his head at the Blessed One's feet. Then go to the Venerable Sariputta, pay homage in my name with your head at his feet, and say, Venerable Sir, the householder Anathapindika is afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill. He pays homage with his head at the Venerable Sariputta's feet. Then say, It would be good, Venerable Sir, if the Venerable Sariputta would come to the residence of the householder Anathapindika out of compassion.' 'Yes, sir,' the man replied, and he went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to the Blessed One, he sat down at one side and delivered his message. Then he went to the Venerable Sariputta, and after paying homage to the Venerable Sariputta, he delivered his message, saying, 'It would be good, Venerable Sir, if the Venerable Sariputta would come to the residence of the householder Anathapindika out of compassion.' The Venerable Sariputta consented in silence. Then the Venerable Sariputta dressed, and taking his bowl and outer robe, went to the residence of the householder Anathapindika, with the Venerable Ananda as his attendant. Having gone there, he sat down on a seat made ready, and said to the householder Anathapindika, 'I hope you are getting well, householder. I hope you are comfortable. I hope your painful feelings are subsiding and not increasing, and that their subsiding, not their increase, is apparent.' Anathapindika replies, 'Venerable Sariputta, I am not getting well. I am not comfortable. My painful feelings are increasing, not subsiding. Their increase and not their subsiding is apparent. Just as if a strong man were splitting my head open with a sharp sword, so too violent winds cut through my head. I am not getting well. just as if a strong man were tightening a tough leather strap around my head as a headband, so too there are violent pains in my head. I am not getting well, just as if a skilled butcher or his apprentice were to carve up an ox's belly with a sharp butcher's knife, so too violent winds are carving up my belly. I am not getting well, just as if two strong men were to seize a weaker man by both arms and roast him over a pit of hot coals, so too there is a violent burning in my body. I am not getting well, I am not comfortable. My painful feelings are increasing, not subsiding. Their increase, and not their subsiding, is apparent. So this description of how painful is the illness and how painful the feelings are for Anathapindika is one of the standard descriptions that we find in other places in the suttas of the discomfort that people are feeling as they are suffering a grave illness and as they're approaching the end of their life. So Venerable Sariputta says, "Then, householder, you should train thus. I will not cling to the I, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the I, the physical I. Thus you should train. You should train thus. I will not cling to the ear. I will not cling to the nose. I will not cling to the tongue. I will not cling to the body. I will not cling to the mind. And my consciousness will not be dependent on the I, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the mind. Thus you should train." Now they are the sense bases, and all of them found on the body. So when we are saying not to cling to those sense bases, we are all, our Venerable Sariputta is also moving in the direction of not clinging to this body. "Householder, you should train thus. I will not cling to forms. I will not cling to sounds. I will not cling to odours. I will not cling to flavours. I will not cling to tangibles. I will not cling to mind objects. And my consciousness will not be dependent on mind objects. Thus you should train." So all of the objects in the external world, which are known through the sense doors, those two you should not cling to. I'll just proceed until it comes to a point where I'll just elaborate on this. "Householder, you should train thus. I will not cling to eye consciousness. I will not cling to ear consciousness. I will not cling to nose consciousness. I will not cling to tongue consciousness. I will not cling to body consciousness. I will not cling to mind consciousness. And my consciousness will not be dependent on all of these different consciousnesses. Thus you should train." So the eye base or the ear base and the object that is within the domain of that base has to be known by consciousness that is of that same kind. So eye consciousness arises dependent on the eye base and forms in the environment. So seeing consciousness, hearing consciousness is arising when there is the sense base working and the object appropriate in the environment. And considering his state of ill health, some of the senses may be declining, may be deteriorating, and the ability to see or to hear or to taste or any of the normal sense impressions that come through that relationship may be deteriorating. But the Venerable Sariputta is saying, whatever you are aware of, not to allow that to invade and take over the mind. Householder, you should train thus. I will not cling to eye contact. I will not cling to ear contact. I will not cling to nose contact. I will not cling to tongue contact. I will not cling to body contact. I will not cling to mind contact. And my consciousness will not be dependent on any of that. Thus you should train. So in the way that experience arises, there is a sense base, sense object, the appropriate consciousness for that base and that object, and when the three come together, there is contact. Eye contact dependent on the eye base, the form object and eye consciousness. Ear contact dependent on the ear base, vibrations or sounds, and ear consciousness gives rise to contact. The contact, which happens with every sense, consciousness, sense base, and sense object, then produces a reaction within the physical form and within the mind. So, householder, you should train thus. I will not cling to feeling born of eye contact. I will not cling to feeling born of ear contact. I will not cling to feeling born of nose contact. I will not cling to feeling born of tongue contact. I will not cling to feeling born of body contact. I will not cling to feeling born of mind contact. And my consciousness will not be dependent on feeling born of any of those contacts. And householder, in this way, Venerable Sariputta is encouraging Anathapindika to not grasp after, not to cling on to any of the feelings that are produced by what he hears now, what he sees now, what he smells now, what he tastes now, what he comes in contact with in the body, and also what the mind comes in contact with through thoughts, ideas, making some sort of story about the situation that is in. So the painful feelings in the body that may be afflicting any part of this physical body, any part of the sense apparatus, producing unpleasant feeling, not to cling to that feeling, to not cling to the feeling and allow the consciousness to be dependent on that feeling. Because what happens when there is contact and when feeling arises, the mind then starts to make a story, including a reaction to that contact, to that feeling. And if it's in this situation, seeing something that gives rise to an unpleasant feeling can increase one's suffering, because with an unpleasant feeling there might be aversion or anger. There might also be a sense of identification with that thing that's happening. The sense contact is seen as, this is happening to me, this is happening to my body. Or the object itself, what are they doing with my things? What is happening to the people that I'm leaving behind? How are they reacting to me? These are the objects in the environment, not just physical things, material things, but people. What are they talking about? What are they planning? All of those sorts of reactions which arise through these contacts. Verse 10, householder, you should train thus. I will not cling to the earth element. I will not cling to the water element. I will not cling to the fire element. I will not cling to the air element. I will not cling to the space element. I will not cling to consciousness element. And my consciousness will not be dependent on the consciousness element or any of those other elements that arise dependent on these factors. So this is directly relating to the nature of this body. Even though this body appears to be made of flesh and blood and all the organs, and that the organs are not working as well as they used to, and the sense bases may not be working as well as they used to, Venerable Sariputta is going back even further in not just seeing the component parts of the body in terms of what we're familiar with, the parts of the body, but the elements which constitute or make up or form those component parts. So if you like to think of it in modern terms, you can say the atoms and molecules that make up the flesh, the blood, the various organs. In the way that we understand all material existence, not just this body, is composed of these six basic elements in different combinations, and that everything that arises has these elements in different proportions. So the earth element has the quality of solidity, has the quality of hardness or softness. The fire element has to do with the temperature of things, whether hot or cold, and the process of assimilating our food, or this process of breaking down things happens when the fire element is very strong or is active. So Anathapindika mentions that he is feeling very strong hot feelings, fever, and that the fever is going through his body. And the heat element has the function of destroying things, burning them up, breaking them up. And so that fire element, when it is personalized and identified with, it is my painful feelings. I've got a fever. It's part of my sickness. Look what it's doing to my body. But if we can see it simply as the fire element, not my fire element, not a special fire element, but just the fire element, then we just recognize the fire element is present in this quality. Now, to be able to do any of these practices, we have to practice them before we get to this stage. And this is what the import of this sutta is about. I'll just continue and then we'll come back to that point. Verse 11. Householder, you should train thus. I will not cling to material form. I will not cling to feeling. I will not cling to perception. I will not cling to formations. I will not cling to consciousness, and my consciousness will not be dependent on this. So this is the five aggregates, the five khandhas, which the Buddha said constitute a human being, constitute any living thing. The material form, which is made up of the four great elements, the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. The space element is there, the places where there is an aperture or a hollowness, and the consciousness element in living beings, which makes it possible to be aware, to be a feeling entity rather than a non-feeling entity like the carpet or the clock or whatever that is an inanimate object. Now, previously when we were looking at the sense bases and the way that sense consciousness arises, contact is produced, and then there is the inner feeling, the internal feeling, or the feeling that arises on the physical form, that is the world coming in to this physical form and producing a reaction, an effect. The reaction is an effect, But then there is the reaction to the effect. And what Venerable Sariputta is encouraging Anathapindika to do is to stop at just the recognition of the interaction, not to go further and to personalize that and identify with it as this is happening to me, my body, I'm dying. I'll continue and I'll speak more about this as we go on. Householder, you should train thus. I will not cling to the base of infinite space. I will not cling to the base of infinite consciousness. I will not cling to the base of nothingness. I will not cling to the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And my consciousness will not be dependent on any of these. Thus you should train. So now Venerable Sariputta is taking Anathapindika further or out of the body, out of identifying with this physical form and what's happening to the body, but is encouraging him not to identify with any mental aggregate, and particularly with the consciousness which knows these non-material forms. So all of these are descriptions of the immaterial meditative absorptions, or they're not called jhanas in the suttas. Usually they're called the non-material attainments. So these aren't to do with this body. They're to do with an awareness or a consciousness of space, reality, that is beyond just this personal, the limits of this personal body, beyond the boundaries of this personal form. In attaining these states of mind, there is a sense that anything that was an object that has a boundary, that has a limitation, is seen as just something that is a relative understanding. The base of infinite space and the base of infinite consciousness sees that ultimately there isn't a boundary that is solid or fixed even in this body. But it's not based on the body, not based on consciousness of the body. At the time of the consciousness of any of these things, there is no perception of the body as a limiting factor. But Venerable Sariputta is saying even those exalted states of mind, don't take them personally. Don't identify with them. Because in all those states, there is still a being who is perceiving the base of infinite space, the base of infinite consciousness. There is still a knower present. And so if you identify even with those exalted states, there is still a sense in which you are there. And so Venerable Sariputta is trying to encourage Anathapindika to even let go of that identification. Householder, you should train thus, I will not cling to this world and my consciousness will not be dependent on this world. I will not cling to the world beyond and my consciousness will not be dependent on the world beyond. Thus you should train. Now the Buddha defines the world as what we can know through this, the five aggregates, through this body and the sense bases and the sense contacts that arise dependent on this body and its mental aspect, the consciousness. And then this world is what we can know through the senses, and the world beyond is what is not dependent on sense contact but is mind only. And this is the mind, the world that is known through the mental absorptions. So one should not cling to this world that we're familiar with or to the mental absorptions, the world that we know through the absorptions. Householder, you should train thus. I will not cling to what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, encountered, sought after, and examined by the mind. And my consciousness will not be dependent on that. Thus you should train. So this is covering all of those bases, anything that is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, encountered. So even if it's not encountered through the body, encountered through the mind, sought after and examined by the mind, and my consciousness will not be dependent on that. Now this verse alludes to a very famous teaching of the Buddha, which he has given one of the ascetics from another tradition, who he counseled Bahia of the bark garment. And in that particular teaching, the Buddha gave this instruction: not anything seen, heard, sensed, cognized. Because when we receive sense impressions and when we cognize it, when we start to process it, what we do is we trigger off a reaction from the, that is based in our karmic inheritance from the past, based on what we feel in the moment and what we associate with this moment based on our previous experience. And that gives us a sense of identity. Our sense of identity arises not just in the present moment from what we are encountering, but from what we add to the present moment from the past. The present moment is interpreted through our previous experience. The feeling that arises dependent on our previous contact. It's a part karmic inheritance. It's a karmic fruiting, the Vedana. The perception of that, identification with it, making a sense of it in the present based on memory, is part of our identity. And when that is triggered in the present moment, the reaction to that is in accordance for the untrained, uninstructed disciple to fit that into the present moment, or actually to fit the present moment experience into that past experience. That sense of self which is already established through our past experience. We try to make the present experience fit into what we take ourselves to be, what our sense of ourself is. We take the present experience and try to, we judge it, we add to it, we react to it in terms of our view of ourself. Our sense of ourself as being the experience that we're having, rather than just the experience happening as a process. I am experiencing this. And so throughout the whole sutta, what Venerable Sariputta has been doing is trying to say, these are the components of the experience that you're going through now. This is a process that is arising through cause and effect, and it is a process that has many different components to it, many different parts to it, and none of those parts should be clung to as a self, as who you are, that they are arising and that they are passing away, and you just let them come and go without trying to form any sense of identity or identification around those components, around those different aspects. And he takes it from the way of the senses, and then this body itself, and then the mind, the mental process, the consciousness that's involved. And in each part he says, my consciousness will not be dependent on what I'm seeing now, on what I'm hearing now, on what I'm smelling now. That is the advice Venerable Sariputta is giving. Now, this is a very subtle point because if you remember when I read that about Anathapindika's first meeting with the Buddha, that he attained the stage of stream entry. It said that the spotless, immaculate eye of the Dharma arose in him and he became independent of others in the Buddha's dispensation. So at the point when he met the Buddha, he developed understanding of the wrong view of self, which sees through personality view. This personality view which sees these component parts as mine, as me, as a self. In the way that the Buddha explains the path to enlightenment, there are the 10 fetters which bind us to samsara, to birth and death. And at the point of stream entry, the 3 fetters that fall away are the belief in rites and rituals as a way of finding emancipation, doubt that the Buddha was enlightened, that this is the path, or that we can follow this path, and also we see through the view of self, the personality view, which identifies ourselves as something fixed, having a solid core, unchanging, that isn't dependent on multiple causes and conditions to exist, to survive, to receive experience, or for experience to be produced. Now, even though Venerable Anathapindika attained the stage of stream entry, where he saw through this personality view, the seeing through the personality view doesn't eliminate the conceit that of I am. Even though there is an understanding that what we take to be me, and if we look in any part of this mind and body, we see that there's nothing that is actually belonging to me that I have absolute control over, absolute ownership over, that is not changing, that is me when I was 5, me when I was 20, me now. We see all of that, but still there is a sense that we are something. And this conceit, I am, only fully disappears at the stage of arahatship. And what happens for the stream winner is that even though the view of self is no longer there, the perceptions and feelings based on the past, the karmic inheritance from the past, still arise in the present moment. And the stream winner has to continually be reminded and continually practice to see that these are not based in wisdom, but based in ignorance. They are the old stuff still coming up. And in the present moment, have to be addressed in terms of the 3 characteristics of impermanence, non-self based on conditions, arising out of conditions, and suffering if they are clung to. And so from the time that Anathapindika first met the Buddha until this time, when he's had the opportunity to practice, establish firmly this undermining this sense of conceit. I am not this, I'm not that, but I'm something. That conceit is still there. It hasn't been undermined. So he has remained at the point of understanding that these components do not constitute a self, but there is still some subtle identification with the process as me. And I'd just like to read something from one of the monks who spoke about this when he was questioned by some of the disciples. The elder Kamika was once questioned on this, and he said, "I do not see in these five aggregates affected by clinging any self or self's property. If there's a self, if there's a sense of me, if there's a sense of I, then there are things that I own. Maybe very subtly still think somehow I own this body. Somehow I own my thoughts. Somehow I own the things around me." When there's a sense of self, there's self's property. And Kamika says, "I do not see in these five aggregates affected by clinging any self or self's property. Yet I am not an arahant with taints exhausted. On the contrary, I still have the attitude I am with respect to these five aggregates affected by clinging. Although I do not see I am this with respect to them, I do not say I am the form, I am feeling, or I am perception, or I am formations, or I am consciousness, nor do I say I'm apart from form, or apart from feeling, or apart from perception, or apart from formations, or apart from consciousness. Yet I still have the attitude I am with respect to the five aggregates affected by clinging, although I do not see I am this with respect to them. Although a noble disciple may have abandoned the five more immediate fetters, still his conceit I am, the desire I am, and the underlying tendency I am with respect to the five aggregates affected by clinging remains as yet unabolished. Later he abides contemplating rise and fall thus. Such is its form, such is its origin, such is its disappearing. And so with the other four, till by so doing his conceit I am eventually comes to be abolished." So Kamika at that point was said to be a once returner, and he was explaining to the bhikkhus that although he was a once returner, he had given up greed, he had completely given up greed and hatred, or greed and hatred had fallen away, and the sense of himself in any of those things was not there. There was still a subtle conceit, I am. And this is Anathapindika not at the same point, not having given up greed and hatred completely, but having seen through the personality view, the view seen through that he's not any of these things, but still this subtle conceit, I am. And Venerable Sariputta, through his teaching, has been trying to help Anathapindika to let go of any of those identifications which may be still there very subtly. When this was said, the householder Anathapindika wept and shed tears. Then the Venerable Ananda asked him, "Are you foundering, householder? Are you sinking?" "I am not foundering, Venerable Ananda. I am not sinking. But although I have long waited upon the teacher and bhikkhus worthy of esteem, never before have I heard such a talk on the Dharma." "Such a talk on the Dharma, householder," Venerable Sariputta says, "is not given to lay people clothed in white. Such talk on the Dharma is given to those who have gone forth." "Well then, Venerable Sariputta, let such talk on the Dharma be given to lay people clothed in white. There are clansmen with little dust in their eyes who are wasting away through not hearing such talk on the Dharma. There will be those who will understand the Dharma." Then, after giving the householder Anathapindika this advice, the Venerable Sariputta and the Venerable Ananda rose from their seats and departed. Soon after they had left, the householder Anathapindika died and reappeared in the Tusita heaven. Now, a few comments on this last part. When Anathapindika says, that he has never heard a teaching like this before, then we have to question why he hasn't heard it. Because in the beginning, the Buddha talked in the very verse that we have in the account of their first meeting. I've just got to find it. Whom sense desires leave intact, cooled without substance of existence, he has rejected all attachments, there is no conflict in his heart. And then he gave Anathapindika progressive instruction. And Anathapindika became independent of others in the dispensation. So this kind of teaching, which alludes to the fact that the peace is found in the mind, was from the beginning the sort of teaching that Anathapindika heard. Now that's one point. The other point about the talk on Dharma is not given to lay people clothed in white. The commentary makes the point, this is not to say that there's an exclusion or exclusive teaching only for monastics, but that for someone who's living the household life and who still has to make a living and look after his family and look after his responsibilities, that it would not be proper to give teaching which requires so much renunciation on the spot of sense contacts of this body, of the consciousness which arises dependent on sense contacts. In another teaching, the Buddha talks, when he's asked about can a householder attain enlightenment? The Buddha says that a householder cannot attain enlightenment while ever he clings to the fetter of householdership. It's not a matter of being a householder or a layperson. It's having attachment to all of the things that go along with being a householder, to one's material prosperity, one's family, one's career, one's acquisitions, one's place in society, all of those things. That is the fetter of householdership, not whether one is a householder living the lay life. But if one considers being a householder, the obligations that one has to fulfill, then you can see how fulfilling those obligations takes one constantly in the other direction, from giving up in this moment a sense of ownership over even one's sense contacts. So I would like to make two points on this. One, it seems to me from this sutta that this is an indication of how we hear the teaching only to the extent when we're ready for it. We can hear the teaching on wisdom. We can hear about the teaching on the development of blissful states, inner peace through concentration. Until we're ready to hear that, we don't hear it. And then until we're ready to hear what's necessary to accomplish those results, we don't really take notice of the causes necessary to accomplish those results. It's not that we don't actually hear them, we're not actually exposed to them, but our mind isn't inclining in that direction. Now, at the point of where one is on one's deathbed, it starts to make sense that one realizes all of the things that we've accumulated and spent our life accumulating, all the people that we hold dear and consider to be precious and we can't do without, all of those are shortly going to disappear from our life because we're going to die. This body which we've been identifying with and giving so much importance to, the senses which we've indulged and which we've enjoyed indulging, which we've considered ourselves to be very competent and successful because we're able to indulge them in the way that we like to, these senses themselves are starting to fade. This very body is becoming more and more unreliable. And at that point, the teaching starts to make sense personally. We're willing to hear it, we're able to hear it because it's staring us in the face. And so I would like to make that point in this sutta that I feel that's more what this teaching is pointing out. Anatta Pindika was a very devoted follower of the Buddha, and he had many, many opportunities not only to hear the Buddha when he came to his house, but also to go to the monastery and hear the teachings that the Buddha was giving. And it's not conceivable that there were never opportunities to go and hear these deeper teachings when he had access to the Buddha. And in fact, there's another story from Anatta Pindika which I didn't have time to look up and find completely. There's an incident where one of his daughters is dying, and she refers to her father as brother or son, I can't remember which of those terms, and he thinks that it is because she's delirious as she's dying, but it's actually because she's further advanced on the path than he is, and so she looks to him as being a little brother in the Dharma to her, because she's already at the point of non-returner. And so hearing that even the slave in his household could become a stream winner and other people in the household could advance, I think the explanation given that these teachings aren't available, haven't been heard, is perhaps not exactly the way that we should take it. We should take it as a reminder to all of us that being in contact with the teaching and hearing the teaching doesn't mean that we are actually listening and taking it in and putting it into practice. In order to be able to understand that these sense contacts are impermanent, what is impermanent, permanent, is not mine. It can't be clung to. It's not a refuge. We have to practice right here and now. We have to practice moment by moment, again and again. And whatever it is that we take to be mine, whatever it is that we're identifying with as me, whether it's on this body or just mentally, we have to start to hold that up for reflection. Where does this come from? How is it produced? How stable is it? Does it last? Do I have control over it? If I try to cling to it, is there suffering or not? This is what we have to do throughout the course of our life, so that the mind is prepared for the time of death, not only just to die peacefully, but to use that experience for our growth in wisdom. Now, are there any questions or comments on what I've said? And I'm just suggesting this as something to reflect on. We know that the Buddha described himself as a teacher with an open fist, so there's no sense in which some teachings are for the select, for the monastics, and not for the householders, but basically those who are ready to renounce are the ones who are likely to hear the teaching when it's given. So I'll just continue with the finishing off. So Anatta Pindika died and went to the two-seater heaven, which is a very high heaven in the form realm. Then when the night was advanced, Anatta Pindika, now a young god of beautiful appearance, went to the Blessed One, illuminating the whole of Jeta's Grove. After paying homage to the Blessed One, he stood at one side and addressed the Blessed One in stanzas. O blessed is this Jeta's Grove, dwelt in by the sagely Sangha, wherein resides the king of Dharma, the fount of all my happiness. By action, knowledge, and Dharma, by virtue and noble way of life, by these are mortals purified, not by lineage or wealth. And he, being a very wealthy person and having been very prosperous, he knows that's not the way to be purified. Therefore, a wise person who sees what truly leads to his own good should investigate the Dharma and purify himself with it. Investigate the Dharma, remembering how that matches what we've been talking about. Sariputta has reached the peak in virtue, peace, and wisdom's ways. Any bhikkhu who has gone beyond, at best, can only equal him. That is what the young god Anathapindika said, and the teacher approved. Then the young god Anathapindika, thinking, "The teacher has approved of me," paid homage to the Blessed One, and keeping him on his right, he vanished at once. When the night had ended, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, last night, when the night was well advanced, there came to me a certain young god of beautiful appearance who illuminated the whole of Jeta's Grove. After paying homage to me, he stood at one side and addressed me in stanzas thus, 'O blessed is this Jeta's Grove, dwelt in by sagely Sangha, etc.' That is what the young god said. Then the young god, thinking the teacher has approved me, paid homage to me, and keeping me on his right, he vanished at once. When this was said, the Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, 'Surely, Venerable Sir, that young god must have been Anathapindika, for the householder Anathapindika had great confidence in the Venerable Sariputta.' Good, good, Ananda, you have deduced the right conclusion. That young god was Anathapindika, no one else. That is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Ananda was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words." So that is the end of the sutta, and I'd just like to reiterate the point that even at stream winning, when the view of self, the view of I am me, a fixed entity, continuing, unchanging, there's something in me which is inherently me and which has been me before, will be me in the future, that is seen through. But the fetter is the conceit that though I'm not this person with this name, something, I am something. Something is here. And we keep on reinforcing that sense of there is something here with our feelings based on the past, with our memories based on the past, which then are triggered in the present. And when they're triggered, we try to fit the present into that past sense of ourselves. So there is this ongoing connection from the past, the present, and then what we make of this in the present is our becoming. So in order to break that up, we have to start holding all of those things up to reflection. Is this arising independently? Is it arising under my control? Does it stay as long as I want it to? Does it stay the way that I like it to? Does it change? Is it impermanent? What happens if I try to manufacture it? Is that suffering? This is how we need to examine our experience again and again, to weaken that sense of somehow this is me, so that we prepare the mind for the time, if not before, at least at the time of our death, that we can not cling to any of those things as who we are. You're still functioning because the process is still going on, but there's no one in there who's making it happen. The delusion is the process goes on even without the sense of self. The process is for as long as there is life. The process is happening. It's like we're breathing and our blood is flowing through our body, and we don't think, well, I've got to keep an eye on that blood, make sure that it's moving now and that the lungs are... We just take it for granted that those things are happening. The whole process of cognition and experience is the same. There's not someone in there who's doing it and making sure that it happens at each moment. And so it just happens. Well, we try to control. The idea that we can control is delusion, but we try to manufacture control. So if we start to see that things are happening as they are, but what we're adding to it is our reactions, which we have a sense of investment in. That sense of investment comes because we think that our interfering will somehow keep us safe and produce the result we want. Yes, the outcome to the way we want. So the process is happening anyway, but through our wrong understanding, we've somehow made it as though we're making the process and that we've got somehow a way of changing it. Now, we've got a way of changing it when we change the conditions that produce it, but we're mostly looking at the effect, mostly looking at what we don't want now, not seeing where that comes from. And so once we start to see what produces the effect, we understand that and identify there are certain things we can change. So instead of getting irritated because a sound is happening, a sense contact is happening, and there is hearing consciousness arising, and instead of rejecting that sound and getting unhappy about it, we just allow that sound to be there, and there's no resistance to it. And then there's sound just does its thing, and we just do our thing, register it, and just move on to the next moment. But when we resist it, we wish it to go away, then we manufacture something which we think is getting rid of the sound, but it's manufacturing something in us which is suffering. That is a unpleasant feeling. It's a reaction. So once we realize what we're doing, we can stop reacting gradually. And so the effect is the sound arises, we just sound. Yes. It will pass anyway, but we don't go out and disturb it and then produce something a negative within us, unpleasant within us. Yes. Yes. So this teaching is quite profound, obviously, and I think it's just important for us to consider, you know, here is someone who was in constant contact with the Buddha and had all these opportunities, made this wonderful good karma, and was still at the stage of their death, still not fully penetrated to the truth. So then we don't have to be so judgmental about ourselves or so impatient about the results we should be getting. One of the points I made about Punyika, who was the servant, the slave girl who became a stream winner and then entered the nun's order and became fully enlightened, was that she had practiced as a nun under several previous Buddhas, and it had taken her eons to get to the point where she was born into the environment where she could hear the Buddha again, have the opportunity to go forth and continue to practice and become enlightened. So we don't know how long we've been doing this for, how long it's taken us to get to this point. So we can really be happy that we've at least reached this point and just patiently persist with the work at hand and rejoice while we do it. So if there are no
questions or comments?
Question about the memories from the past coming in and affecting the present, whether it's this life or even previous lives, depends. What we consciously remember usually is just this life. But we don't know if there's some conditioning from even before this life. We may not be consciously aware of that. But say, for example, we have an affinity for music, and that is an identification that we have. We may have been cultivating that through lifetimes, but we only have a memory in this life of our affinity with and our experiences with music. But the fact that we're very a prodigy, that we're very skillful with music, you know, maybe is an indication that we've been doing this for a while before we got to this level. But we don't have any conscious memory of it. But the fact that we're a prodigy will have meant all sorts of different experiences in this lifetime, because now we're really good at it and now we get a lot of pleasure from it, and now we give a lot of pleasure to other people, and we may have been fated because we're a prodigy. And so the content of our memory and how much it sticks to us will have been affected by that. You know, if we're just tinkling with the piano and we can't make two notes together, no one is going to pay us for that. No one's going to make us a big deal of that. So our sense of identity with that is not going to be so strong. So we may not consciously be aware of it, but we can see what's arising in our life now has got a lot of weight behind it. So understanding this sense of self and the I conceit, as I said, that it only falls away completely at full enlightenment. So we shouldn't be discouraged if it still baffles us, or if we have an inkling but we can't quite keep that inkling going once we get out into our normal life. But every little bit contributes to our greater understanding. So thank you for coming, everyone, and now I'd just like to share the merits, and all of you, as I chant this verse, those of you who know it, please chant with me, and those of you who don't know it, when I speak about may the merits made by me, that's for you to mentally also share the merits for yourself. May the merits made by me, now or at some other time, be shared among all beings here, infinite, immeasurable. By rejoicing in this cause, this gift of merits given by me, may beings all forever live a happy life, be free from hate, and may they find the path secure, and their good wishes all succeed. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And please note in that verse, cause and effect. Cause is the merit that we've done and our wish to offer it to others, and that they get the chance to rejoice in it is because we're offering it, that's the effect. If they rejoice in it, they create new causes for their own happiness. So, thank you, everyone, and have a happy Christmas, and maybe see you next year.